Okay, so the death process, let's continue. So the mind could stay in the body. And of course, for most of us, unless we're yogis, we're unconscious. But it is possible, like the example of the woman. But yes, it's possible because the mind is still there, and because subtle mind is like the dream mind. And now we've discussed the experiences. For example, in my case, even though I was asleep and dreaming, I was also aware of the sounds. I remember reading about some, actually, Italian mother who wouldn't let them pull the plug on her boy who was in a coma for 25 years. He came out of the coma. He said he was conscious the whole time. So in other words, his grosser physicality, his elements didn't come back. He couldn't come back into his body. The four senses, the elements, the earth element and the other elements didn't function. But his mind was conscious. He was there. So it could be the same, and that's why to keep it quiet in the room. If you keep the body there for 3 days, you treat it like a shrine room, you know. I mean, we're so gross in this way. There's grandma in the bed, in the hospital, even before she's dead. She's unconscious in a coma. We think it doesn't matter what we do in the room, you know. It's not true. The mind's incredibly sensitive. And people in a coma can also be aware, like if you're in a dream. And the energy can be, they're so sensitive at that point, so you wouldn't keep the room always quiet. As Rinpoche says all the time, always quiet. The only sound should be mantras. The only sound should be prayers, things that benefit the person, you know. It's the same when they're dead, when the gross consciousness has ceased. Their subtle mind can be there, and it doesn't say that, but we can see from experiences it could be aware. So everything in that room that should happen there for those 3 days is for the sake of that person. In the monasteries, you know, for example, they have prayers 24 hours a day for the 3 days, you know. So much benefit. But if you know the mind has left, you don't need to keep the body for 3 days. It's clear you don't need to. And there are ways of checking. So, you know, for example, one typical way when those red, white and red drop continue, when the drop opens at the heart and the consciousness leaves the red and white drop and takes and goes into the, wakes up in the intermediate state and that person is now finished, then the red drop will continue down and out and the white one will continue down and come out here. And I forget for the male and female, it's opposite, so I can't remember which one. That's as a sign the consciousness has left, like a subtle liquid energy. But another way to check, as long as the mind is there at the heart, you put your hand above the heart. And this is the dog as well, the cat and the dog as well. It'll be distinctly warm. So ideal is 3 days, if you can. In hospital, clearly, it's hard to do that. You can't have a bed for 3 days. They're waiting for the beds, you know. But I think it's really important if your loved one dies in hospital, you negotiate with the hospital in advance. Hospitals are very kind. Don't just wait till the person dies and you have a panic attack and the doctors and nurses take over. They'll do their job. But you need to know what you're doing and so you can request beforehand, if there's an opportunity, can we leave the body as long as possible? So if your grandma dies at 1 a.m. and no one else is there, you tell the nurses to leave her alone and call me, please. If you're with her when she dies, don't call the nurses and doctors. Leave her as long as you can. So you can do prayers and practices and all, you know, all in the book, things to do. And then if you have to leave the body, you have to go, leave the hospital, and you're not allowed to take the body home, and these days you can't do that, I think. I mean, when Lama Yeshe passed away, it was interesting. He died in a hospital in Los Angeles. This is back in 1983. They allowed them to take the body. It's very curious. You can't do that now. They were able to take the body. They drove it down the road in a car. It took hours and hours and hours to go up north to Vajrapani Institute, where they kept the body for 3 days. Then we had the ceremony, the fire puja, for 3 days at Vajrapani Institute. But I think you can't do that now. Once it's in the hospital, you can't take it home again. But if it's at home, you can take the 3 days. And if it's in the hospital and you have to give the body over, then okay, you do what you can, prayers as much as you can, as long as you can. And then there's a way of trying to encourage the consciousness, if it hasn't left yet, to leave the body. And one thing you can do is you tap. They say tap or pull the hair very vigorously at the crown chakra. Very vigorously. And that can encourage the consciousness to leave there, which means it could be a sign they can get a rebirth in a pure land. And we'll talk about that. But the other thing to do, and we put it into this, you know, the paperback version coming out next year, there's new information in there from Rinpoche. I remember one time when one of our nuns died. Once she died, Rinpoche checked up and said it was best to have a fire puja, you know, to burn her body in 10 days. So what are you going to do for 10 days? She has to be in the fridge, doesn't she? Well, then I said to Rinpoche, well, is that possible? If they can't take the body home, if they can't have 3 days in the hospital bed, how about they ask the hospital to put her in the fridge? He said, that's possible. Why not? So you could do that. Hospital, the mortuary, very gently take it there and leave it in the fridge. And then you do all the prayers and practices at home. You don't disturb the body. The key thing is to know what you're doing. And if you're in hospital, to negotiate with the people, to know, and you be in charge of it. Don't hand over your power to the doctors and nurses. There's certain things you want to do, you need to do. You should know this. And the next scenario, of course, which is a very tricky one, I mentioned this, is that taking organs. I mean, on the one hand, Rinpoche and all the lamas praise people. They say the motivation is so pure, it's incredible, to want to give your body to people. That's amazing. So if you die with that pure motivation, it'll only be a good rebirth. But I think Rinpoche didn't realize, and I mean, I didn't know either, and then when I was discussing it with him, and so his responses are in the book, you know, that he, you know, apparently, he, as he says, if they leave, they keep the body breathing. Well, he said, of course, if the body is able to breathe, the mind has to be there. In other words, using this Buddhist view of what death is when this consciousness leaves the body. The materialist view is only if they stop breathing, the body is all there is, and they're now not alive, because you can't see that they're breathing. You can't see any movement. You can't recognize the signs of the presence of the subtle consciousness. So it's tricky, because all over the world for centuries there are reports in all cultures of people coming back to life. So, of course, in the materialist view, they don't know how to answer that, so they just kind of leave it. Just kind of, it's like a joke, you know, we don't know what it means. Well, for the Buddhist view, it's very not an uncommon thing. You go through the gross stages of death, you stop breathing, but your karma is not yet to die. You haven't finished yet. So you come back into the gross consciousness. And that can happen. So to have to burn the body immediately, which I've heard Jewish people do and I've heard Hindus do, that's not appropriate. So it's a difficult one. And then, of course, the one of organs I mentioned, I think. I told you the story, didn't I? About the TV monitor, the nun, the nurse monitoring the heartbeat. That's a very typical example. And in general, as Rinpoche says, because the senses are no longer working, and if you're on the operating table, and it's like you're unconscious. I mean, you're just literally unconscious, that's all. If the mind is still there, you're unconscious, although you look like you're dead. It's a very dramatic unconsciousness. And most people won't have an experience of seeing what's going on. So for most people, it won't be disturbing to take the organs. It's true. It won't be. And Rinpoche even says in the book, even if they have taken the organs and cut you open, it still doesn't mean the consciousness has left. It still doesn't mean the consciousness even will leave. But on the other hand, if like that woman, you've got this experience, your subtle mind observing that they're about to cut you open, because she would still know it's her, she's still got this, she's in that body and she knows she's Mary or Fred. So she's going to have a panic attack. Of course she will. They're about to cut me open. Don't they realize I'm not dead yet? That would be a horrific experience. That brings incredible fear, and that could easily change the karmic seed to give a suffering rebirth. So it's a tricky thing to do, you know. You've got to think about that. In my personal opinion, there are so many ways we can help people. Don't have to just give them organs. And this man, interestingly, this American journalist was quite cynical about the whole profession. He said it was very arrogant, very elitist. People really misused it. Of course, ego gets involved, doesn't it? In many countries now, you know, this system, they force the law to change that they will take your organs unless you say otherwise. Usually you had to give permission to take your organs. Now it's the other way around. They will take your organs automatically unless you've given permission not to, unless you've said not to. That's really quite outrageous, you know. Do you understand what I'm saying? That's quite shocking. In Holland, it's like that. I don't know what, in Italy too? That's very shocking. That's just the power of all the doctors. With respect to the doctors, they all mean well, and it sounds, this is me being talking now, I'm not trying to be cynical, but it sounds so holy, and it is amazing to give an organ to keep a person alive, but it's kind of manipulating people's emotions, you know, and then forcing it to be the law. That's very, very arrogant, you know. So, of course, the other scenario is if your loved one dies suddenly. they're eating their soup and they drop dead. It happens. We know that. It happens. That's those stages going very quickly, just like that. It happens. So then you've got to have a wits about you as well. Mostly be panic and call the hospital, isn't it? A friend of mine in California, the mother, the father and the daughter were all Buddhists, and the father had a really bad heart condition, and he got his wife to promise that she would not call the ambulance if he had a heart attack. Well, she forgot. He had a heart attack. He's vomiting, you know, and he had a heart attack, so she calls the ambulance. She panicked. That's what happens. He didn't want that. So they took him to the hospital, and then the daughter and I went in there like dawn, and you could see he was really distressed. He knew what was happening. He didn't want all these wires, you know, all these things in his body. So we did all the prayers he wanted, and they took the things out. And then this is another way to do it. Rinpoche didn't say this, but this is my experience. The hospital were very kind. They took the body very gently, put it into the ambulance, and took it to the mortuary, not very far away, very gently. And then we were able to stay all day with the man, you know, in the mortuary, saying prayers and practices. And then they made us go home at 4 o'clock, and they put him in the fridge with the other dead bodies. Well, we gave them a CD of the Gyuto monks chanting, and they promised they'd play it in the fridge. So all the other dead bodies got the Gyuto monks chanting. You understand? Then we took the body out again the next day, and we did more prayers and practices. So there's many ways you can do it. But you have to, as Rinpoche says, we need this education, you know, if you take this view. So if you love someone dies suddenly, I mean, of course, if you know how to make sure they are dead, if you can do all the recuperating thing, if you can do that, but if you really do see they are dead, then before you call the ambulance, do your prayers and practices. Help the person's mind. Help their mind. Once you call the ambulance, it's out of your power, you know. You've got to be really conscious and be aware of what you're doing and know what's important to help the person's mind. This is a crucial time. By saying mantras, that's the most... See, that's if you're the Buddhist approach, this is the only thing you can do at this point. They can't do anything. But the power of hearing prayers and mantras is said to be huge, you know. People can hear at a subtle level. They can be aware, and the Buddha is invoking the presence of the Buddhas to be there to help. Is there any questions from all this? Okay. Yep.
Quando le persone muoiono, chi è buddista dice che questa persona ha lasciato il corpo. E questo. No,
go. When the people are dying, the Buddhist people are saying that the person has left the body.
Sorry, no, I understand. That doesn't make sense to me. What do you say? Start again. That doesn't make sense to me, Tashi. Sorry.
È corretto dire che la persona ha lasciato il corpo o soltanto i lama lasciano il corpo e noi moriamo? Dire che noi moriamo è una cosa più corretta, è giusto?
The question is normally when the Buddhist people are talking a person that died, we say the person has left the body. Is it correct to say that everybody has left the body, or is only the lama are leaving the body and the other people are dying?
I don't understand. I'm really sorry, Tashi. I don't understand the question. Say it a different way.
È corretto dire che una persona ha lasciato il corpo quando muore, o dire semplicemente che è morto?
Is it correct to say that a person that dies has left the body, or just simply saying as dead?
We have to. The main first question is we have to define death. So death, from the materialist point of view, is when you stop breathing, and when the heartbeat stop. That's what they call death. The Buddhist view is, taking the Vajrayana model, is you're not dead until the consciousness has left the body. So that happens whether you're holy or ordinary, or whether you're a rat or a dog. You go through this process. All sentient beings, all the animals go through this process as well. So when you are confident the consciousness at the very subtle level has finally left the body, and that can take up to 3 days after your breathing stops, then you are dead and you have left the body for everybody.
Yes.
Is that clear?
Yes.
Okay, thank you. Someone else? Any other questions about this? Yes, Ron. Just hand it over. Hand it over, Tashi. Give it through the people. There we go. Yeah.
When the chronic seed is triggered in the earlier stages of health process...
Forgive me, Ron, can you start again?
The chronic seed, when it is triggered...
Yes, yes.
...in the early stages...
Yes.
...is it possible to change the virtue of the seed?
Exactly, yes, I understand your question. Is it possible for another seed to be triggered later? Yes, absolutely. That's why it's important not to disturb the body. So if a virtuous seed has been, for example, the person having their organs removed on the hospital bed, the example I gave, let's say she died with virtue in her mind, and then a virtuous seed was triggered, but there she is being kept alive, and now she's on the hospital bed, and she happens to be able to be noticing what they're doing, and then they see her cutting her body, and she still knows it's her, so then she has incredible fear. That's why her heart went from 100 to 200 beats. We can deduce that she freaked out. That can change the karma. Exactly. And it's the other way around as well. If you die with a negative seed triggered and you're in the intermediate state, Rinpoche says there are various practices that you can do that can help reverse it, and a virtuous seed can be triggered. It's the same either way. There's various practices we can do to help the person. Yeah. One of them is called Jhangwa, which is this very long ceremony, and it's best that the lamas do it, those who are qualified, the monks or the monasteries, where you bless the remains of the dead person. The ashes or part of the body. And that's said to be a super powerful... Rinpoche said it's such a powerful practice. It's one of the practices he really recommends. He said then it makes their ashes and their remains like a holy object. And that can hugely help the karma of the person change. It's a really powerful and necessary practice to do. So if you've got the ashes of your dead mother sitting on your mantelpiece, get them blessed with Jhangwa. It can help your mummy, you know. It makes the actual ashes a holy object, something so precious. That's how the lamas say. There are many other practices you can do as well to help the mind. Exactly. Yes. Someone else. Yes.
Same with people, for example, with Alzheimer's. Is there any kind of specific practice to help them?
Exactly the same as everybody. No difference. No. Not a fraction of difference. Okay. I mean... If you can die, if you're conscious and you can die with awareness and you can hear the prayers, you can think about your lama, that's the best way to die. But most people, even if they haven't got Alzheimer's, aren't conscious, are freaking out, aren't happy. So everybody's the same. So whether it's Alzheimer's, a baby, a mouse, or you're conscious, the same practices, not from the person, they can't do much. There are practices we can do to help their mind. All the more powerful, especially if it's an animal or a baby or a person with Alzheimer's or they're unconscious. The only thing we can do is do all the holy practices, the mantras, the prayers. So, of course, if we're not Buddhists, they might sound like superstition, but we've got to understand how those practices are so powerful. And they're the main ones for Rinpoche. So, he says, so many of these practices and prayers, so many sutras and mantras, so many. I mean, I remember weeks and weeks and weeks trying to gather all the mantras Rinpoche has discovered. He's like this, he's famous for finding mantras that nobody else knows, you know, and he loves all his mantras. They're like really powerful medicines, all got their different function. This is much of the practices of these types of things. They're the things that he would say are the most powerful to help people, the most powerful. Animals as well. Do you understand? Do you understand? Jhangwa. Do they do it here?
Yes.
People do it here. So, yeah. Many of the centers who have, you know, resident Tibetan monks who are trained, they're the ones who they can do this thing, you know. You can even do it yourself if you wanted, but it's got to be done properly. You can get the text from FPMT, but it's best if you have other people do it. And they need the ashes. They need the remains to bless them, yeah. Yeah.
Also after a long time.
Yeah, why not? Absolutely. The consciousness is somewhere, so help it. Absolutely. Yes, for sure. Yeah. What else, people? Okay. So when your mind leaves the body, then that second the indestructible drop opens, you now become an intermediate state being. And now you are finished. People say different things here. You hear different lamas say different things. But all I know is Lama Zopa says, from the second you leave the indestructible drop, that's the end of this package. And even if you're in the intermediate, when you're in the intermediate state, because it's your subtle mind, you can even see your body but you have no connection, no interest in going back because there's no longer a memory of it. It's all finished, you know. It's finished. Karma finished. So they talk about how you can stay in this intermediate state, which really is exactly the same experience as a dream. And as we know, you can have very powerful, terrifying dreams, and you can have very nice dreams. But always, in general, unless we're practitioners, we're not in control of those dreams. They're kind of weird, you know. Same with the intermediate state. But because it's a more dramatic kind of dream, because you're out of the end of this life, and you're waiting basically for the conditions to ripen for you, for your karma, to then, for like in our case, we were in the intermediate state waiting for our new mummy and daddy to hop into bed, you know. And they're all discussing these days what happens if the egg and the sperm are in a petri dish. And this is a typical explanation in the texts. Now, I'll tell you now what happens when you get reborn. So clearly that's got to be questioned now when you think about the egg and the sperm being all fertilized in a petri dish. So the typical text, the traditional way they say, you know, what happens is you're in the intermediate state in our past life, and then, you know, the karma has already been triggered to go to our present mummy's human fallopian tube or whatever. But this is what I want to discuss. It's an interesting point. But what happens in general, they say, in the intermediate state, because your mind's more subtle, because of the karma now ripening when your mummy and daddy start to have sex, the karma ripens and you're driven by powerful attachment, unbelievably powerful attachment, because this is an attachment realm. This is a desire realm created over eons by attachment. And the most powerful attachment is contact with a human body. We label it sexual. So this consciousness, you leave the intermediate state and you're driven, if in my case as a girl, I was powerfully driven by sexual attachment to have sex with my father. They literally say this. That's just, try and think of it as powerful attachment. Don't think of sex as something special. It's just attachment. And that's what drives this universe. Look at it. And then when you get there in a millisecond later, you get the attachment is thwarted and aversion arises because all you see is the sex organs. And that causes you to die in the intermediate state, and then you join the egg and sperm, and that's the new life beginning. And if you're going to be born a boy, you're attracted to your mother. That's how they say. But if it's a petri dish, don't ask me how it works. I've no idea. They've got to discuss all these things. And the other thing that I find interesting, just now, because I was editing, doing the final proofs of this paperback version of this death book of Rinpoche's, and normally Rinpoche would say when the consciousness joins the egg and sperm in the mother's womb. Well, we know technically it's not in the womb, it's in the fallopian tube. And then I wanted to be clear, from the Western point of view, when is conception? So I looked up on Google, and it says, so if anybody knows here, please help me, it says that the sperm can take up to half an hour to join the egg in the fallopian tube. Now, all I know is, and I've heard many women, and I mentioned this before, so please try and help me understand this. It's very curious. And I've heard different things in the Buddhist teachings. That when I was, and I told you I got pregnant, remember, when I was a hippie, and I was with that boy, and that second of the action, I knew I was pregnant. I knew something had gone inside me. I didn't call it a consciousness. I didn't think like that. But it was a crystal clear awareness. Now, if that's true, this doesn't make sense that it takes a half an hour for the egg to join the sperm. You see what I'm saying? It was right that second. So that does mean whatever. Have you read about this, Ciliana? I've heard that in the teachings they talk about how the consciousness joins the male thing first. I don't understand. I can't quite work it out. Are you seeing what I'm trying to say? Because the egg and the sperm are the basis of a body. You can't just have one or the other. So if I had that awareness, and many other women say the same thing, it was the second of that action with that boy. It must have been when the sperm hit the body, you understand? It must have been, to speak about it. But then if it takes a half an hour to fertilize the egg, then that makes nonsense of this. So that must mean the consciousness must go there sooner. That's all I'm trying to say. I mean, it's a very, and I've read something about how it joins the male part, the male first, goes through the male something or other. It's not the way we tend to think. So it's an interesting point. But the other point I find fascinating is the whole business of cloning. You know, cloning, it's not an egg and a sperm. They get two cells. They get a nucleus from one and a cell from another, and they're not the egg and sperm at all, and that becomes the basis of the consciousness to join it. So the only way, I think this is what I've heard, that this red and white drop, as they call it, these are components of all the cells in all the bodies. You don't need to be so-called male or female. It seems all bodies have them because they talk about how you need this red and this white one. So I don't know. It's interesting anyway. It's an interesting discussion. So anyway, that's death. 12 o'clock. Any questions? About death. I mean, I haven't talked about all the things we can do to help. There's so many ways of helping. And the key way, the way we put the book is, it's like in chronological order. First of all the weeks and months before death, in the case that you're going to die slowly. And really, for a Buddhist, that's the best way to die, you know, because you can be ready for it. You can prepare. And there's lots of practices. Most of the practices Mishri recommends, all the holy things. Well, first of all, there's a chapter on what to talk about. So this is a practical one. This is whether your mother's a communist or a Catholic or a Buddhist. One of the practical ones is you're trying to help the person become calm and relaxed and feel safe and secure. So you show lots of love and kindness. You don't need to say holy things to them. You can talk about their good... One of the major ones is talk about their good qualities. I mean, it's rare that we think about our own good qualities. And especially if you're sick and you're dying, your mind's out of control. You've got a lot of anxiety, you feel a lot of guilt. So to talk about them and talk to your grandma, even though she's been a cranky old grandmother, I don't care. Tell her what a wonderful grandmother she's been. Tell her how much you love her. Tell her how people love her, what a good job she has done. Calm her mind down. Make her feel good about herself, which helps her relax, you know. Especially, it's so important, especially with parents. If we've got a lot of bad history and haven't forgiven them, this is incredibly powerful for their mind to be able to do that, and for you too. People have such shame and guilt if their mummy dies and they haven't forgiven them, you know. It really is important to... But the key thing to remember, it's for your sake too, but we're discussing the dying person here. The real point is to remember all the things we do, all the prayers you say, all the things you talk about, everything that's in the room, whoever's in the room, everything is for the benefit of the dying person. We get so much involved in it so emotionally, you know. I mean, when a person saw this manuscript and I asked them to check it, she said, "Where's the chapter on grief?" I said, "This book has got nothing to do with us. This is to help the dying person." And this is where it's quite different from the materialist view. And in the materialist, I mean, these days, there's so many wonderful doctors and nurses doing wonderful things to help people die, babies and everything. I've run many conferences, you know, but it's got nothing to do with what happens after, because that's religion's job. But this book, of course, it's for the dying person, and then what to do when they stop breathing, and then what to do when their mind leaves, and then there's half, a quarter of Rinpoche's practices are what to do after they've left the body. There's so much to do, you know. There's so many things. It's not just to die. And I remember one time, I mean, yeah, there's so many good doctors and nurses now. I remember one conference I went to in Sydney at a children's hospital. And the doctor there was amazing in trying to get people to get beyond their fears, because fear of children dying is so much pain and hurt in people. So people live in denial of it and don't want to talk about it and feel ashamed of it. So this man was such a lovely man. And there was this wonderful conference, many people talking. And he had the mortuary, the morgue, for the children's morgue, for the little babies and the young children. He had it decorated like a nursery, and it was open, and all the little brothers and sisters walking in and out, "Come and meet my dead brother." I mean, it was so moving because it was cutting the fear, you know, which is amazing for everybody, but that also helps the dying person. But when we realize everything we're going to do is for the dying person's sake, then one of the key things, as Rinpoche said, for example, you keep the people, if they're very attached to certain people, and those people are attached to them, and there's just lots of weeping and clinging. This is a disaster at the time of death. That's about the worst thing you could do for the dying person. So if you're in control of the process, you've got to really control who goes into that room and who doesn't. Not to be like a policeman, but to be really conscious of the effect that certain people have on your beloved who's dying. It's so important. Everything should be conducive for the dying person to be peaceful and virtuous. For example, you keep the pets out. That's shocking for our culture because we just adore our pets. But that creates incredible attachment in their mind. And, you know, if you're going to die with attachment to your pet, don't be surprised you get born a dog. You don't want that. And also the other one is, it seems surprising, to make the room beautiful. Because the person who's lying in this room day and night, full of anxiety and sick and getting weaker and weaker, if they open their eyes, all they can see is confusion and mess. It's so distressing for the mind. He says it's to have beautiful views and space. Everything, so everything in that room should be beautiful, should be to help the person's mind. Everything. There's nothing in there that should be helping not to cause them confusion. It's really important. We have senses. You make the senses happy. You make the person spacious. When one of our friends, Tricia, the nun Tricia, died, she was in Australia. She'd been running Root Institute in Bodh Gaya for years. And she went to a doctor and she's just riddled in cancer. And they said she'd be dead in a couple of months. So Rinpoche said, well, stay in Australia, might as well die there. No benefit in trying to get better. So she went up to Queensland and our centre, Chen Raising Institute. But next door was this place where these people run it, which is utterly beautiful. It's like living in Bali. It's so beautiful, with beautiful views and lovely houses with open windows, because it's tropical up there. So she chose to stay there in this beautiful room with a beautiful view. It makes your mind peaceful. I mean, when sick rooms have windows closed, curtains closed, machines everywhere, medicine. It's so distressing, you know. We don't think about these things. This is really helpful to the person. And then if they're a Buddhist, you have images, wherever they can turn. So one of my friends, very sick, who's always lying down, she's got, you know, her gurus right there on the wall up above, you know, so she can see them. Whatever you hear should be helping your mind. Whatever you see should help your mind. If you have a guru, if you like the Buddha, all those images. If your mummy's a Catholic, if she sees Jesus, you know, the saints, it triggers something in their mind. It's beneficial because we have senses, so you use them, you know, to help them. Keep all the fights out of the way. Keep the troublemakers out of the room. Keep the pets out of the room. Make it very calm and conducive for the person to die well. So important. And as you are getting sicker, we can see the person's mind becomes more and more sensitive to the tiniest noises. The smallest noise can be beyond distress, you know. And if the mind's full of fear, death is a nightmare. And that's why, you know, with all respect to nurses and doctors who are so kind, I think about the worst way to die is in a ward in a hospital. It's so distressing. Everybody else's dramas and, you know, emotions and noise and banging and sounds of things and other people crying. It's the worst place possible to die. If you can afford your own private room, best, you know. It has to be peaceful, quiet, conducive, sounds of mantras, sounds of prayers. I remember visiting one old people's home, you know, and old people's homes, I don't know about in Italy, but there's some of them are just so hideous. Like these old people, you know, drugged out of their brains, unconscious, and just with television blasting all day, you know. No awareness of what we're doing to people's minds, how to help their minds. And this one old lady, like an old grandmother, paranoid, crazy, just crazy. And we're sitting with her. I think, how to help her? We just started singing. I just started singing a mantra. Instantly she calmed down. Like the sound. Sound is a very powerful sense. You can even be unconscious and hear the sound. I told you the story, didn't I, about my friend who was deeply unconscious. Remember that one I told you that? And I said, Judy, His Holiness, No, it wasn't you. No, I confuse when I say things. Must have been the last group. Where was I? Somewhere, Spain somewhere. I'll tell you this. A friend of mine in Sydney was in a deep coma in the, you know, the emergency room, what they call, the, you know, the emergency room. They didn't think she'd come out of a coma. Actually, she tried to kill herself, in fact. She wasn't a Buddhist, but she knew the lamas very well. She'd had Sakya Trinza stay in her house. She knew his family. She'd had Tsongsa Khyentse Rinpoche stay in her house for 6 months back in the 80s. She had lots of Buddhist artifacts. But she was a bit of an alcoholic, and she kind of got depressed, and she tried to kill herself. Anyway, her husband, who's a judge, those are my friends, I asked him if I could go and see her, you know. Best was in the evening because it's quiet then. So, and he rang the hospital and asked if I could come in. He told them that I was her like her priest, you know, but I was a Buddhist. And they all got a bit worried. And when I got there, they said, please don't ring any bells. I promised I wouldn't ring any bells. So anyway, I just stayed there with her for half an hour. There she was, all these wires in her, completely unconscious, you know, and I just would say prayers in her ear. And I'd asked the students of those two lamas to get the lamas to do prayers for Judy, you know. So every now and again, I'd say in her ear loudly, Judy, His Holiness Sakya Trinzen's praying for you. Judy, Tsongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche's praying for you. And as well as prayers. Anyway, she was in there for weeks and weeks in a coma. And she came out of a coma and I saw her, all perky and happy, you know. And she said the only thing she could remember was this voice. She said it was a husky voice. She thought it was a blue lady coming through the window saying, Judy, Tsongtsa Khyentse Rinpoche is praying for you. Judy, His Holiness Sakya Trinzen. That's the only thing she can recall. Now, I can't explain it, but that's pretty tasty, isn't it? The Buddhas, you know, the power of the holy beings, the power of the Buddhas. This can help animals as well. So this mantra, just saying this mantra to this old lady, instant calm, you know. Like it like anchored her mind, you know. So this is easy to help people. We think it's so, we don't know what to do, we panic. This is the easiest way to help people. So if you can, if your old grandma's unconscious, You have a, you find a way to have CD or iPad or something with mantras close to their ear, very tiny, subtle sound that's there 24 hours a day. You couldn't do more for your animals as well, you know. You couldn't do more. You couldn't do more. It's the most powerful thing to do to help their mind, you know. And I think don't get nervous because your grandma's a Catholic and you put Buddhist mantras on. You're not cheating her. If it helps her mind, it helps her mind. Come on. Of course, you can't force it on them. Or, even, you know, one example, I think some couple, the husband and the wife were both Buddhist. And the husband was a bit fanatic. And the poor wife was really sick and she was, you know, sleeping a lot of the time. And every 2 hours, she'd wake him up. He'd wake her up to do her prayers. The poor thing was exhausted. I mean, leave the woman alone, please. Do you understand? I mean, be kind, you know. You do the prayers instead. Poor lady, you know, she was exhausted. So we're understanding this, you know, then we know how to help. So this is the education everybody needs. Whether it's the mouse, the ant, the dog. And that's the one about killing our dogs and killing our cats. We of course we do it out of compassion. But it doesn't mean you're going to help the dog and cat. We maybe helped ourselves, being compassionate, very kind of us, but we didn't help the dog. The way to help your dog, you know, is to help it die peacefully. And the dog, because your dog adores you, your dog will trust everything you do. And as soon as if you're there, it'll feel safe. Even if it's in pain, it'll feel safe. So keep your dog in a comfortable place where it's secure and safe with mantras playing day and night. You just cannot do better for your dog than that. Okay, give it a painkiller, do whatever you like. But this whole idea of killing the dog to stop its suffering, half of it's just our fear, our attachment, because we can't cope. It doesn't help the dog, because if the dog's going to die with fear, then how have you helped it? Straight to the lower realms again. You haven't. Even the ant. Put the ant on the altar, blow mantras on it, help the little ant. All sentient beings, you know. Every time you see animals, Rinpoche has all sorts of practices. Like, for example, one thing, he's got all this, he says you can get talcum powder or perfume or small seeds or whatever, and he does all these millions of mantras. Then you blow on these seeds, you blow on the talcum powder, and he has little packets of it. And if he's driving along in America or driving on in Australia, he stops and he sees a kangaroo, he'll hop out. And he'll sprinkle, because he's blessed it, he'll sprinkle it on the kangaroo and he'll say prayers in its ear. If you're courageous enough, you can do that. Okay, if you start doing it, you'll never stop because you're going to see dead animals everywhere. And he says, and they said another way you can do, another one they talk about, you can get pills that have been blessed. Say pills that have been blessed by His Holiness and the monks in Dharamsala. And they're very powerful and blessed, so you can get a bit of, you put those in the mouth of a person. Another thing you can do is have sand from a sand mandala that's been blessed, Kala Chakra or something. Then you get a bit of butter or something on the crown and you stick a bit on there. And he says, and then he said, and then when the person's dead, you take that and use it for the next person. It's very practical. There's so many practices Rinpoche has, I can't tell you. Okay. I don't know what else to say. It's only 10 past 12. About death. Done enough about death. Well, let's continue then with the compassion wing. Okay, so essence of junior school, we haven't gone through all the main points, but the essence of it is it culminates in ethics, controlling your body, controlling your speech, at least refraining from doing more negative actions. Why? Because you don't want suffering. This is the main purpose. Not out of compassion yet, it's for you. We've got to get that. We've got to get that, and often we don't get that one because we tend to think it's selfish. We've got to understand it. When the more you understand what suffering is by understanding the Four Noble Truths, the more you understand what, you know, karma, the more you will want to have respect for yourself and not create yourself further suffering. That's the essence of junior school. Purify, live in vows, powerful, potent. Now you go to the next level, second scope, middle scope. Now you start to get to the root of the problem, the delusions, the mind. You see, both of these prepare you for emptiness. If you understand karma, as I said, it's a perfect example of the first level of dependent arising, cause and effect. And you can, it really helps you loosen the grip of ego grasping, loosen the grip of suffering and poor me. Then you go to the second level and you learn about the mind, Buddha's presentation of how the mind works, in particular the mental consciousness, in particular the neurotic states of mind in the mental consciousness, how they're disturbing, they're delusional, they're exaggerated, they're distorted, they're misconceptions. The more you understand that and how they mislead you, both of these lead you perfectly to understand emptiness when you get to the six perfections. Because karma is a first is an example of the first kind of dependent arising, cause and effect, and the way the mind functions in the second level prepares you for how ignorance functions. This is more subtle and more primordial, that's all. So it's preparation psychologically. It's psychological presentation of all the practices preparing you for each next stage. You have to understand that. That's why the structure is like that. So once we've got some level of renunciation, you know, we can go to the compassion wing. So the essence of this, another way of presenting the emphasis, the essence of practice in the first, in the wisdom wing, junior school and high school, is it's the practice of the ethics, practice of the morality of restraint, the to discipline your body, speech and mind, to refrain from harming. This is the crucial emphasis. Now we continue working on our mind. You don't stop working on your mind until you've achieved Buddhahood. But the emphasis here is different. Like I said also too, the first level, if you want to look into the mind, the main problem is attachment to get what I want. So we control the servants of the mind, the body and speech, and then the attachment itself. That's the essence of renunciation. Now we continue working on our mind, moving into the bodhisattva path, but our emphasis, our motivation, the emphasis changes. It continues being the practice of morality, the practice of ethics, but now it's in relation to helping others. And the other way to present here the main problem, it's also the way of putting the more dramatic level, the one of transforming problems, the one of exchanging self for others. This is a really radical way of achieving bodhicitta. This outrageous attitude, which the transforming problems is from, is we're trying to make this radical shift in the mind where we stop cherishing self and we now start to cherish others. That's the main problem all the way through. The assumption of the problem in all the techniques in the bodhisattva path, the assumption of the problem is to cherish me. And we're trying to gradually shift that into cherishing others. It's like attachment in a different way, basically. So the first lot is all about protecting oneself from harming others and therefore future suffering for oneself. This one is helping how to help others. It's a more radical, more dramatic, clearly demanding more wisdom. So this is also expressed in the different levels of vows. The first level of vows are the prati moksha, individual liberation. This is the wisdom wing. This is the Theravadan part of the path, the Hinayana part of the path, shared by all the teachings in Burma, Thailand, wherever. It's the same here. So the vows here are the vows that help you do that job of protecting yourself from future suffering, which helps you get out of samsara, which helps you liberate, achieve your own liberation. Now we take the next level as the bodhisattva vows. The emphasis in these vows, and they're all about behavior, the same, but the emphasis here is in how to help you know what's best for others. It's much more radical. And you can't know that if you haven't done the earlier stuff first. Because you're too self-centered, too full of yourself. You can't see past your own nose. So the very first series of practices that culminate in the achievement of bodhicitta is presented in different texts. There's two main texts over the centuries the Tibetans have used, coming from the Nalanda tradition in India. One is the six causes and one effect, and one is called exchanging self for others. But there's a nice presentation of the combination of these two, and it comes to 11 different points. And the 11th is the culmination. It's the accomplishment of bodhicitta. So what is this bodhicitta? Often we use it as an equivalent of compassion. It's not. It's the result of compassion. It's a powerful state of mind that really is where now others are coming first. Genuinely, stably, not just a moment and by moment, but it's an actual genuine realization where you truly have exchanged self for others. And this alone is a pretty outrageous concept. It does not fit with our modern psychology. It sounds like mental illness. There's two main components of bodhicitta. Bodhicitta, awakening attitude, awakening thought is what it means. But it's referring to this very powerful attitude of now, first, there is the only thought, the thing that is arising in your mind is only others. To even say these words is shocking. In our culture, that would sound like serious mental illness because we have to factor in a very strong sense of self in the way we talk. And we have to include that. And then we can afford to incorporate others. But to say to be as radical as actually putting others first all the time, that's too weird for us. We don't have understanding of that at all. So we've got to see clearly, as we've been talking, the Buddhist approach, the Bodhisattva approach, you know. So the first part of bodhicitta is this spontaneous and continuous thought to only benefit whoever's in front of you, right there. Not going, oh, I want to benefit sentient beings. No, not like that. Right there. The ant, the human, the dog, the person, whoever. And because you've got incredible wisdom, you know, you're not just being kind of what we think about when we think of benefiting others is all being nice. No. Benefiting others means you've got wisdom to know what they need. And like a mother, that could be tough love. So bodhicitta is not just weak and sentimental. It's powerful. It's rooted in wisdom. Some level of wisdom of knowing what's best for that person. But the spontaneous immense connection, because you've gone beyond to a certain degree, a profound degree, a sense of a separate self. You mightn't have realized emptiness yet, but you're pretty amazing already. So there's this genuine realization that others are more important than you. And this is hard to hear, like I said. And the other second component of bodhicitta is the long-term goal, that you are moving toward your Buddhahood and you will do anything for as long as it takes to help you become a Buddha. So a bit like the analogy of the surgeon. You know your job, you wake up in the morning and your job description is surgeon. And you're in the war zone. Your job is to help whoever's in front of you. That's it. Spontaneous, automatic. And the longer term view is, because you're still training, you're a bodhisattva, you're still training, you're not a fully developed surgeon yet, you're still training. So every second you help whoever's in front of you, and your long term goal is every second you're moving towards becoming the best surgeon in the universe, Buddha. So that's the long-term goal, no matter how long it takes. Life after life, you are perfecting and training and becoming a Buddha. That's bodhicitta. And it's the result of powerful compassion. And not just compassion like we talk, but great compassion. Like I said, compassion is, oh my God, look at the suffering. Great compassion, the unique characteristic of the bodhisattva, is what can I do to fix it? That's like universal responsibility, His Holiness would call it. It's the courageous attitude of the bodhisattva. It's my job to do it. So the starting point, one is these series of 11 little techniques that culminate in bodhicitta. It's our next phase of practice on this path. Transforming problems comes later on. We're still not really there yet. We've touched upon it. So the very first one is the foundation practice. And we have a lot of misconceptions about this. I think we're very wishy-washy about it. And this is simply called equanimity. It's got a very specific meaning. And it's the foundation upon which we will grow stably each realization as they come, which culminates in bodhicitta. So there's different ways in Buddhism of describing equanimity. So in the first stages of practice, when you really got yourself together with a bit of renunciation, you would say you've definitely got equanimity. And the equanimity here at that level is your mind is more balanced. You're not up and down like a yo-yo. You're more stable. That kind of equanimity. And that's marvelous. But here, it's a completely different equanimity. It's in relation to sentient beings. It's an attitude in relation to sentient beings. And this is the basis. So equanimity here is the heart, this is my way of saying it, this heartfelt recognition that friend, enemy, and stranger, and there's no fourth category on this planet, because they're the object of attachment, aversion, and ignorance. That friend, enemy, and stranger are equal to each other from one point of view. They all wish to be happy. They all wish not to suffer. It's quite precise, you know. That's equanimity. This itself alone is profound. To realize this, to get this, already is incredible. So what is it? Why are we trying to get it? It's hugely important. So love is, may you be happy. Compassion is, may you not suffer. As we're pointing out, and as Buddha points out, every being in the universe wants happiness and doesn't want suffering. And all he is doing here, like we discussed, is he says, I've got my methods of how to get it, babies. Our method is to follow attachment, right? And because of that, we have friends. And then because when they don't do what we want, we become enemies. And then the ones who do neither, they're strangers. This is the universe. Monkeys and dogs and ants and humans all function this way. Friends, enemies, and strangers are simply the manifestation of the three poisons. And all the realms of existence are described in this sense too. It's Buddha's analysis of the whole universe. So naturally we have people we like, people we adore, people whom we do love, people whom we do have compassion for, and they are labeled friend. And what does that mean? They're the object of our attachment. And as long as Ron does what my attachment wants, I'm prepared to love him and have compassion for him. And that pretty much is how we tend to be. Okay, so we can see with mums, even if the daughter gives you up, she still wants her to be happy and doesn't want her to suffer. We can see that. But mostly in the world, when a person stops doing what my attachment wants, they stop being the friend and they go into the enemy category or they go into the stranger category. Like some of your past ex-husbands, you don't even remember them because they just become strangers. They're boring. Some become enemies and some become strangers. There's no other option. So a friend, by definition, in this framework here, is the object of your attachment. Therefore, they look gorgeous to you, and you have lots of love and lots of compassion. We do have love and compassion, but that's usually for that group. And that no one questions. It sounds weird in our culture to think you've got to love everybody. I mean, that's wacky, you know. So then we have this with the enemies. We mightn't use that word, but it's a useful label for people who don't do what our attachment wants. And who even harmed us. Now, of course, that's the person we have aversion for. Of course. The rat, the ex-husband, whoever. So we don't want them to be happy and we don't have compassion for them. In general, look at the world. Of course, when you start becoming conscious, it changes. But the instinctive response of animals, ants, dogs, humans is this one. And what's a stranger? Well, like I said before, well, no, I didn't, but I'll say it here. That's 99.999% of the universe. And who are they? Sentient beings who've neither harmed nor helped me. That's it. And how do we care about them? Couldn't care less. They could all drop dead. Like those, you know, Tanzanians when I read about it. Not Tasmanians. Tasmanians are the friends and Tanzanians are the strangers. I didn't care one way or the other. That's the point. That's the point. Strangers. That's how it is. And this is utterly natural because this is samsara and everybody's in samsara. So this is Buddha's analysis of samsara, you know. Friends, enemies, and strangers. So here we've talked, before we talked about the three poisons, but now we're talking about them being reference to sentient beings, not just objects. So what we're trying to do here, ending up putting all sentient beings first, which means having infinite compassion for all sentient beings, we've got to change the logic for why we want to do that right at the beginning. So right now, the so-called logic of samsara, which is not logic, is I want my friends to be happy and I have compassion. I try not to think, but naturally you don't care if the you know, you're almost happy if the enemy suffers, and you don't care about the strangers. This is samsara. So what we're trying to prove to ego in equanimity by simply thinking, recognizing that each those friend, enemy, and stranger, you try to, in this meditation, we'll discuss it after lunch a bit more, it's now lunch, we're trying to get our head out of the, we're trying to get ourselves out of the equation. We're stepping back and we're trying to see these three categories, and you put three people there, even for this 4 minutes while we're talking, have a person in the friend category to the left, have an enemy in the enemy category right in front of you, and have a stranger in the stranger category. A person whose face is there, whom you don't, who know enough to put them there, but who has not touched your life. We can see already, it's so clear. You know, so what we're trying to do here, using logic to argue with ego's misconceptions, is stop, we're trying to go beyond the logic of samsara, which means we only want friends to be happy and not suffer. We're trying to see that these three people, from their point of view, nothing to do with me, get yourself out of it. From their point of view, these three people, this is the point, are equal to each other in wishing to be happy and not suffer. This we have to prove logically, not just emotional. You know, and this takes time. It's hard work, using logic to argue with ego's ridiculous misconceptions. That's equanimity. So that becomes the basis. Because they're all... So instead of, oh, I want you to be happy, why? Oh, because you make me happy. I want you to be happy, why? Because you want to be happy. That's love. We know this one. Your mother says, whatever makes you happy, baby, that's genuine love. Love that says, I want you to be happy as long as it makes me happy, that's polluted love, which we mostly have because of attachment. We're trying to shift that and to see the person as separate from us and want them to be happy for this because they want it. Not because they help me. That's the difference. It's very precise. That's equanimity. And already profound. We can practice this in daily life. This is amazing. So we'll continue after lunch. So, okay, we finish and we think of our lunch again differently. Let's think of our lunch as both empty and the product of the handiwork of sentient beings and the death of all. So we think in different ways. We put bodhicitta and what compassion. I haven't answered your question yet, Klamo, about how to make everything bodhicitta. She's not listening. She's fixing. We'll do it later. We're going to get to it. What your question about how to die with bodhicitta, we're going to get to the point of how to do everything with bodhicitta. We're coming to it. Just reminding you. I haven't forgotten. Okay? Okay. So, okay, let's think of lunch. First of all, what is lunch? Lunch is this vegetables and bread and butter and maybe butter, I don't know. Olive oil if you're Italians, I suppose. And rice and pasta and things and, you know, people and the people there serving it, and those people in the kitchen have cooked it, and people drove it from the shops, and people served it in the shops, and people grew them in the ground and drove them to the shops, and all the trillions of sentient beings who died on the way. This is a fact. This is a fact, you know. I've got to keep remembering this. We forget that when we're vegan and vegetarian. We get very kind of holy, thinking we're so holy because we don't eat a piece of flesh. That does not mean that sentient beings aren't being harmed. There's absolute certainty. I think I mentioned, didn't I? I forget what I mentioned. When someone criticized me on my my Facebook page for eating cheese. So I first showed about the trillions of creatures that die on the road. I said that one. But the other piece of the other thing I read about, I put it on the Facebook page as well as an answer. Some Australian scientist got fed up with all the fundamentalist vegans sounding so holy. And I'm saying fundamentalist is the problem. Vegan and vegetarian, it's divine that we live this way. I mean, no one can complain. But the point is, He said that he'd pointed out this particular wheat field. You grow wheat. Now, who's the wheat for? Well, 20% probably for the bulls, for the meat eaters, let's say. And then 80% is for the vegans and vegetarians, of course. But what happens? In the off season, when there is no wheat growing, millions and millions of these cute little field mice live there, gather there. He had photos of them. He said they sing love songs to each other. They're so cute. And guess what you have to do when you have to plant the wheat? Well, you have to slaughter the millions of field mice. Now, everybody knows that, but we somehow go, well, you just can't help that, we will say. But it's kind of irrational. All we're pointing out is when we eat food, sentient beings suffer. But when we're very, I think our problem is we're so attached to food, to eating, that we get obsessive and then become extreme and fanatic and think, well, you know, that's just collateral damage. You can't help the poor old mice. But I'm sorry, they died a tragic, shocking death just so we can have our wheat. Well, how can we think that's not suffering? Well, it's just because you don't eat the mice. It's just very bizarre thinking, in my opinion. Can you get my point? We've got to remember this. So fantastic, don't eat meat. And I mean, these days Rinpoche is really stressing this. And I think his agenda is so we can get some compassion. You know, at least have compassion. But let's extend it to the poor little mice. They don't kill them gently. They slaughter them. Millions. So we can grow wheat for the holy vegans. I mean, get my point. I'm not being political here. Can you hear my point? We've got to open our minds. But there's a strong resistance. I remember some fellow emailed me and argued. No, you just can't help this. No, this doesn't matter because we're obsessed with eating. It's so peculiar. You think about it. It's quite irrational, really. Which doesn't mean you go, oh, well, you don't say I don't care and then eat meat again. That's not the issue. But just be realised that just by existing, we are harming countless sentient beings. So here we are thinking of all these thousands, millions of beings who've suffered and have worked just so we can have lunch. This is very marvellous, you know, the kindness of sentient beings. And in this 11 steps to bodhicitta, we'll discuss this one. The attitude, what it is, you know. So we think of all of them. And then we think, okay, first, then we think we're going to bless the food. This is from Tantra, really. We're going to imagine this vast container of blissful nectar, no, this food in a big container, and we imagine Om Ah Hung melting into it, the energy of the body, speech, and mind of all the holy beings, and it turns into this transcendental, marvelous, blissful, empty nectar. It has no inherent nature. And then we think we must offer it. That's where all the merit is, as Rinpoche says. So we imagine all the gurus, all the Buddhas, all the bodhisattvas, all the sentient beings. Pervading space. Then we'll do one more step. If you have a guru, if you have faith in a Buddha, then you transform all these sentient beings, all the gurus and Buddhas and sentient beings into the guru, into the Buddha. Trillions and trillions and trillions of our guru yidam. If you have, you know. This is the most potent object of our merit. So then finally we see them all experiencing the joy of enjoying this nectar, this delicious food. How marvelous that we could do that. Lama Sangye, Lama Che, Dejen Lama Gedon Te, Kongi Jepo Lama Te, Lama Namla Che Pabul. So that minute of thoughts is so stupendous, so powerful, so virtuous that we've just put a great big powerful new piece into our usual action of eating because of attachment. We've added a virtuous motivation to it, and that's what makes it virtuous. And this is what we're going to discuss more, the power of motivation and how it transforms actions. And that's the answer to, we're going to get into Lamo's point, how do you die, but how do you do everything with bodhicitta? It's a technical thing, and we'll describe it later in more detail. So again, do your discussion based on whatever you think you've heard, the death process especially, and the death thing and all this. Have discussions and then come up with your questions, and I'll see you at 4:30. When? 4:15. Why, what's today? Something different?
Yes.
What happens today? Friday. Okay, Friday.
We have a break for half an hour.
It says 5:30 on my list. Presentation at 5:30. What's the 4:15?
4:15 we have to start.
It says here 4 o'clock teachings for 1 hour. Well, 1 hour of teaching at 4, it says. Not 4:30, yeah.
4:15 till 5 o'clock.
I've got 4 o'clock till 5 o'clock.
No.
You got that, have you? Well, then, okay. But so there's a meditation before that, isn't there? I know, darling, but wait a minute, please. 2:30 to 3:30 we have discussion groups, and 3:30 to 4 we have meditation.
Right.
Well, why is there a 15-minute break?
15 minutes. Why?
Oh, you want a break, do you? Okay, that's fine. Have a break. I don't mind. Of course. Whatever you like. Have a break.
So you come here at 4:15.
Okay. If you want a break, have
then
it.
We finish in 45 minutes. Then
but then why is there a half an hour break there? Fix the room. I see, okay. I see, okay.
30 or 50 people are coming.
Okay, at 6:15, and then at 6:30 to 7:30, a sharing experience.
Yeah, but I don't understand how it's going to work all this.
We don't worry, we just turn up, yeah?
Yeah,
we're supposed to turn up. This is our gig. Okay, good, we turn up then. We turn up and see what happens. Okay. Okay. Oh, okay. All right, better.